Welcome to the first Race and Health podcast. My name is Dylan Devakumar and I'm an academic and public health doctor based in University College London. This podcast is part of the Race and Health group that looks at how racism and xenophobia affect health. Today's co-host is Abby Devanagam. Hi, Abby.
Hi, Dylan.
Can you tell the listener a little bit about yourself before we go on to the podcast?
Yeah, sure. So I am training to be a public health doctor as well, like Dylan, and I also have an interest in research and teaching.
Fantastic. And you are also part of the Race and Health group?
Yeah.
So today's podcast is on deforestation. So I should say that I have an ulterior motive here in that when I first started Race and Health, my wife told me I needed to look at racism directed towards Indigenous people in Brazil. So my wife is Brazilian. So I thought this is a perfect opportunity to tackle some of those issues. So even for me, when I thought about these two issues, racism and the environment, I didn't really put them together. Can you tell me a little bit about environmental racism and what that is even?
Yeah, sure. Maybe it might be useful to break environment and racism down separately before we put them together. So when we talk about racism, there's many different ways and forms in which people experience racism, and racism can be measured and happens. We can sort of broadly separate it into individual acts of racism and then perhaps institutional and systemic racism, to be very simple. So individual racism is racism that people experience day to day due to a human action, interaction, and then we have systemic racism.
And that's what people think about normally, is somebody shouting nasty words.
Oh, absolutely.
How does that fit in with the environment then?
Really good question. So I think in order to understand environmental racism, we actually have to take a step back and look at racism in systems and racism in institutions and racism in policies. So if we look at the Amazon, for example, we have a gigantic amount of land, twice the size of India, 6.7 million square kilometers of land. And in that land, we have numerous different indigenous tribes and indigenous people living there, over 160 different groups of people living there and societies living there. And there are policies that neglect the needs of these people. And I think that is quite a good example of how racism is experienced through systems. So it doesn't necessarily have to be one person shouting something nasty at someone. It could actually be a policy that fails to actually respond to someone saying, no, I don't want this happening in my land. If we put these things together, so environment meaning the natural environment that we live in and the earth that we live in, and racism, putting them together makes us understand that environmental racism is the disproportionate way that collapse of the environment affects certain groups. Racism is often thought of as something that has to be actively done, but it can perhaps also be passively experienced through certain policies.
That's a really good way of thinking about it and explaining it. And this is really interesting, isn't it? You know, what's the role of Brazil for the people in Brazil, or for the whole world and the responsibility for the whole world? I mean, Jair Bolsonaro was elected on a popular vote and he was the most popular candidate. And that's what the people of Brazil certainly wanted in 2018. But also, it's, I guess, similar in the way we think about the US, in that when a country has a leadership role, when it's such a massive, powerful country, the impacts for other countries in the region, but in the case of the Amazon, for the rest of the world.
Absolutely. So I think it would be nice to try and connect some of the dots ourselves. We can do it together. So maybe we can try and connect how me nipping down to Co-op, I mean, Co-op could be Lidl or Sainsbury's or Asda or Tesco.
we don't endorse any supermarkets here.
we don't endorse any of them. We'll say the names of these companies because these companies are directly associated or have been directly associated with deforestation. So say you've gone to your Sainsbury's local to buy, you know, something for your dinner on a Sunday night because your weekly shop has run out, and you've bought some burgers. How does that impact the health of an Indigenous child in the Amazon?
So, I guess this relates to the global economy, doesn't it? And how everyone is connected. So we can't say that what happens in somewhere like Brazil or any other country is isolated. And we all play a part in that because it's all part of the supply chain. And we are the demand wherever we are, in London or Liverpool or anywhere in the world.
Yeah, those burgers that you've bought, very likely to be one of the largest meat producers in the world called JBS. Now, JBS is one of three large meat suppliers in Brazil who actually have had connections to deforestation and illegal deforestation in the Amazon. And that's essentially the link there. And there's lots of campaigning and lobbying from people like Greenpeace, who actually found this link, to encourage big supermarkets like Tesco, like Sainsbury's, Lidl, Co-op, Waitrose, to look at their supply chains. Because I'm sure if we had, I don't know about you, Dylan, if you saw a label or a sticker on these beef burgers saying these burgers are from Brazil and deforestation is connected to this, you might think twice about buying those beef burgers.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, even within my own family, my wife has gone from a Brazilian meat eater to a vegan. But I guess this goes into kind of the climate change discussions on lots of issues, on recycling, on driving electric cars, on, you know, how much of this is at the door of the individual, or is it about those big companies who kind of make the rules and kind of push politicians through overt lobbying, through covert lobbying? If we think of some of the corruption scandals within Brazil, for example, related to every level of government right up to the top, you know, there are massive pressures on politicians to make policies in favor of big businesses.
Definitely. And I think I'd like to sort of reflect on the connection through a researcher from the Oxford Martin Future of Food program called Dr. Marco Springman. And he said the UK directly imports about 30,000 tons of beef preparations from Brazil. As far as I'm concerned, this means when we eat meat, we have deforestation on our plate.
Thanks, Abby. Let's unpack that further by moving into our first interview.
Our first guest is Leila Salazar Lopez, the Executive Director of Amazon Watch. And Leila has over 20 years of experience where she's worked to defend the rights of indigenous people through grassroots organizing and advocacy campaigns in Amazon Watch and many other organizations. Hi, Leila. So lovely to have you with us today. Something that perhaps not everyone is aware of is that climate change does not affect all of us equally. And that is essentially the crux of what environmental racism is. And I just wanted to allow our listeners to perhaps explore a definition of what that actually is with you.
Environmental racism is basically the disproportionate impact of environmental harm on a certain population, right? And when I say a certain population, it's usually, you know, Black, Indigenous, and people of color. You know, if we just think about oil development, where does oil development take place? From the point of extraction, the Amazon rainforest, to the point of refinement, where refineries are. And that's really what happened in the Ecuadorian Amazon, the Peruvian Amazon, and so on for decades. Oil companies were allowed to go in, develop their oil infrastructure, and literally drill and dump. They saw the rainforest as an open, you know, an open resource to develop and exploit. They said there were no people there. Well, there were people there. There were lots of people there. There were five different indigenous nationalities there whose territory was developed on. But the governments didn't protect those people. And that's an example of what is completely wrong with that kind of development, and why it's so important that as any development is further continued, that there must be respect for Indigenous rights. You know, there is the United Nations Declarations on the Rights of Indigenous People. There is ILO 169 that guarantees the right of Indigenous people to have free, prior, and informed consent.
So what would consent look like when we don't have environmental racism?
Permission, right? It means, doesn't just mean consultation. Doesn't mean we're going to inform you. It means you say yes or no. And most of the time, Indigenous people have said no, and the governments and companies still disrespect their right to say no. You know, when I think of that, I think of the Quechua people of Sarayaku are protect 135,000 hectares of primary rainforest, which they call the living forest. And their living forest is basically what they say is that, you know, the forest is alive, every part of it. right? From the tiniest microbe and ant to the biggest kapok tree, everything is alive and everything has a purpose. They, in the early 2000s, the Ecuadorian government gave permission for an Argentinian oil company to go onto their land without their consent, without their permission. And what they did was when the oil company, accompanied by the military, came onto their land, they resisted. You know, unfortunately, there was a lot of violence committed against them, but they resisted and they basically said, we have a right to say no. We will never allow, you know, you onto our land, because we've seen what these companies have done in the north. And so they resisted. And after they exhausted all of the different media and legal recourse in Ecuador, they took their case to the Inter-American Commission and then the Court of Human Rights, and they won. And they won their case because their rights had been violated. Their right to say no was violated. So when you say, what does consent look like? It means you have a right to say no.
Thank you. That's a really simple, as you said, way of answering what consent is. Consent is the right to say no, but it's also not overlooking the indigenous knowledge that, as we talked about earlier, is generations of knowledge, and really allowing indigenous peoples to take ownership and leadership of these proposals and these planning.
Right. Climate change, climate chaos, I would say, that we're living in, affects everyone. But if you're already living next to a refinery, you're going to feel it even more. You know, I'm thinking about, you know, the fires that are raging across California, that are raging across the Amazon, and not just California, the entire West Coast of the United States. These interconnected ecosystems are on fire. Our planet is literally on fire. Our planet is on fire because of the climate crisis, because of intense heat waves, because of drought, and because of deforestation in the Amazon.
Yeah, and it's very scary when you actually realize and connect all the dots. This is a direct impact of the fires that we're seeing in California that exposes inequality and exacerbates inequality. So as you said, it's all interconnected and it can be quite scary. We talked about environmental racism being defined as the disproportional impact of climate crisis on certain minoritized people. But I suppose the next step of that definition is realizing that that is on purpose. It's not an accident. It's because of some of the things that you've mentioned. It's because of the fact that we're allowing this to happen. And I think a lot of our listeners will probably be wondering, I care about this. This is important and I want to do something. So I just wanted to ask you, where do you think individual action actually fits in?
Yeah. So we all have a role to play in protecting our planet and calling for climate justice and defending indigenous rights. You know, you could take simple actions, right? In your daily life, what you choose to buy, what you choose to eat. You could take action on websites like Amazon Watch, particularly related to these issues. You can go to amazonwatch.org/take action. And we have a number of different actions where you can write directly to the Brazilian government, where you could write directly to financiers that are financing and investing in oil companies that are promoting fossil fuel extraction in the Amazon, that are promoting agribusiness expansion in the Amazon. You can share actions with your friends and colleagues in your social media, but then also join in collective action. There are moments when we have to take action for something that is so unjust, to step out of our comfort bubbles for justice for all of us. And that's what the Black Lives Matter movement really exemplified for the growing movement for social and racial and economic and climate justice. That's really what we're talking about now, right? Like, those are just a few examples. Of course, there's been many more victories that we've had in partnership, our allies on the ground. It's really, you know, them. It's really them on the ground, on the front lines, who are, you know, protecting their lands and resisting destruction every day. And you know, a lot of times they'll say to us, you know, we will resist until the end, but we don't always want to be resisting. We want to be promoting our, you know, our solutions. We want to be sharing our wisdom with the world.
Thank you so much, Leila, for outlining the ways in which we can take action to further climate justice on both an individual and a collective level, and showing us that climate justice is racial and social and health justice. Now let's move on to our second interview. Our second guest is Dr. Sandra De Souza Hakon from the National School of Public Health at the Oswaldo Cruz Foundation in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. She is an academic who focuses on the health impacts of deforestation in the Amazon.
Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Can you tell us a bit more about how vector-borne diseases are prevalent in the Amazon and what exactly are they?
Okay. For instance, yellow fever. The men that work in the gold mine, they get all these sort of diseases. Why? Because they come from urban area to the forest. They carry on the disease too. If they go to indigenous land, what's happened? They are going to leave their virus there. And you know that viruses can contaminate a lot of people. You see what's happening now. When the white men, I mean, the people from the urban area go to there and bring diseases.
What kinds of diseases are brought over?
Diarrhea, for instance, but diarrhea from the water too. Their water in general comes from the river that many times are polluted because you have, unfortunately, artisanal gold mine that use mercury to amalgamate gold. They pollute everywhere around. And in many cases, they are so close to the indigenous land. So this brings problem for the indigenous and especially for the children.
So it's sort of the mixing of urban people with indigenous people that can spread disease that indigenous people aren't used to. What do you think about this issue being a racism issue? Do you think that us not tackling these problems and indigenous people suffering, is this an issue of racism?
Yes, yes. It is because we have different regions in Brazil. And people from some regions, such as southeast or east of Brazil, they think that themselves are superior of those people, such as indigenous people. Our constitution, we have a paragraph that protected those people.
Do you know when it came along?
1988.
1988. Okay, so it's only since 1988 that indigenous people are recognized in the constitution and are liberated, as you said.
Yeah, but nowadays we have what you call issue that the parliament voted to liberate the indigenous land for mines, for instance. We know that Amazonia has minerals, water has everything. So they are people that come from different places in Brazil. They go to Amazonia to explore and to get the gold from the sediments, from the rivers, from the land.
And how does that impact on health? What's the link between that and health?
Yeah, I will tell you. First of all, they bring sexual disease. They bring transmissible diseases. They bring virus disease. They take with them mosquitoes from the urban area to these forest areas.
And these are the gold miners, sorry. Are these the gold miners? Okay.
They bring a lot of diseases. But they are the same. If the gold is going down, the price of gold is going down, they are going to cut the trees.
What about diseases due to burning and fires?
It's mainly respiratory diseases like asthma, bronchitis, pneumonias. When you burn the forest or you burn waste, you have the size of the particle deep is going in your respiratory system. But children, they don't have the lungs because they don't use to breathe these sort of particles too. So also these particles, they have heavy metals. They have mercury. Mercury is going to the air. So when they breathe not only particles, carbon particles. They breathe different metals, gases. Everything is going to their lung.
So it appears that mixing of urban adults with indigenous adults due to industrialization and demand for gold especially can lead to infectious diseases in the Amazon. And children seem to be particularly vulnerable to particulate matter in the air as a result of burning trees, and they grow up to develop respiratory disease. Thank you so much, Dr. Hakon, for your time and insight, particularly on the clinical and public health aspects of the issue. Dylan, what are your thoughts?
I was just reflecting on we can't breathe. I mean, that seems to be one of the quotes for the year, isn't it, in terms of what's happening related to COVID and the effects on patients. George Floyd in the US, and I guess this is one of the issues that has emerged over the past year. You know, potentially this is a kind of watershed moment for all these related causes, fires in indigenous health, COVID and respiratory symptoms, racism and institutional forms of racism.
All these things are linked, and Layla says that environmental justice is part of a bigger movement for wider social justice and racial justice. And it's often Absolutely, said that yeah. You can't have environmental justice without racial justice. The onus is totally pushed on the individual to make the connection and make these lifestyle changes. How hard can it be, and how is it actually that difficult to switch to a vegan lifestyle where you don't buy any meat associated with JBS, or you go vegan and you cut all ties to the meat and dairy industry full stop?
Yeah.
That does require knowledge, and it requires power. The whiteness of veganism suggests that it's a privilege, and it shouldn't be. But then I step back and think, why is this on me to make this difference? And I think one good example is this whole concept of a carbon footprint. The carbon footprint was actually conceived by BP.
Really?
This idea that each individual contributes a certain amount of emission through carbon emissions, and this overall contributes to the climate crisis. And this whole idea of a carbon footprint places onus on the individual to take certain actions to change their lifestyle to reduce their footprint. With that onus on the individual will come motivation or even guilt to reduce as much as possible. Whereas actually, isn't it so interesting that it came from such a huge industry who profits from fossil fuels and is a huge polluter?
And some of the most profitable companies in the world.
And I'm not saying that this doesn't make a difference. Of course, reducing meat consumption makes a difference to JBS, which makes a difference to deforestation, which makes a difference to the indigenous person or the indigenous child's health. But it only goes so far. I don't think we should totally shun individual changes, but I think it's important for individuals to realize that it's much bigger than the individual changes that they can make.
The relationship between racism and climate change is intrinsically systemic. Making that systemic change requires all of us, including political and corporate forces.
Especially Layla talked about, you know, do your individual action, but also do the collective action.
Thank you, Abby, for joining us on behalf of Race and Health. And thank you to our interviewees, the Executive Director at Amazon Watch, Lila Salazar-Lopez, and Dr. Sandra D'Souza Hakon from the National School of Public Health at the Oswaldo Cruz Foundation. This episode was produced and music created by Meetha Hawke and Juhi editing by Sam Gomberg. For more information on Race and Health and the work we do, please visit www.raceandhealth.org. Thank you, and see you all again on the Race and Health podcast. Thank you.